Many of the prayers that we have nowadays were instituted by the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah. Why is that important? Because again, as the Jewish people moved away from one reality, one of prophecy, direct messaging from Hashem to His people, to a reality where the Jewish people would basically have to find that relationship on their own, so the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah played out that change. Okay, all of Ezra Nechemiah and the actions of the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah are to relieve the Jewish people the despair, or to relieve the despair within the Jewish people by emphasizing what makes Judaism great. Again, yeah, that's why I emphasized that verse right at the beginning of Sefer Nehemiah, where they rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash, and half the people were jubilant and half of them were sad, right? You have to realize that if you were changing from a reality of prophecy to a reality that no longer had prophecy, the Jewish people were horrified. I mean, they were in despair. They were shocked. So what the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, I believe, do is they remind us about certain fundamental parts of Judaism and how you're going to relate to Hashem in a post-prophetic age. And now let's prove that. Everyone understand what I just said? Okay. Number one is that Ezra Nehemiah, I believe, emphasizes the... There's not... A lot of this is taken... There's a series of articles by Rabbi Jachter from TABC, a high school in New Jersey. A lot of this is also taken from a book written by Benjamin Lau, which is called The Great Sages, which is a phenomenal book. It's a book on Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers. But in the first chapter... he describes a lot of these concepts as well. Okay, so that's where I got these two ideas from, in large part. Okay, much of Ezra Nehemiah is to emphasize the authority of Torah. Okay, where do we see the authority of Torah emphasized? So let's see. If you look in chapter 3 of Ezra, verse 2. Okay. You find, then Jeshua, son of Yotzadak, Ve'chav HaKohanim Zerubbabel, Ben Shealtiel, Ve'chav, right, all of these names. They built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings upon it, as is written in the Torah of Moshe, the man of God. Okay? Re-emphasizing Torah as the deciding factor in many of these issues. Okay? If you look in chapter 16, chapter 6, verse 18 of the book of Ezra, you have again, give you a second to turn, you have again, they established the Kohanim in their groups and the Levim in their divisions for the service of God in Jerusalem, as is written in the book of Moses. Again, you see that bringing up the whole notion of the Torah. Most prominently, you obviously see that in the book of Nehemiah. Chapter 8, which we just saw, where Ezra makes his reappearance. We read this earlier. I'm not going to read it again. We'll just read one of the psukim. Verse 2. So Ezra the Kohen brought the Torah before the congregation, men and women, and all those who could listen with understanding, the first day of the seventh month. What's the first day of the seventh month, by the way? Rosh Hashanah. Right, so they're sitting there on Rosh Hashanah, and Ezra basically takes out a Sefer Torah in front of everyone and reads the Torah. Okay, again, you have in this post-prophetic stage an emphasis on the authority of Torah. This also, Rabbi Jachter suggests, is why we have so much emphasis on documents and on letters. Okay? Because essentially to show that the authority of written documents is what reinforces the Torah. In other words, if you accept that ancient documents and ancient letters carry some form of importance, then you can also accept that the Torah carries importance and credibility. Okay? So there's a linkage between the authority of the Torah and the authority of documents and letters in and of themselves. That, he explains, why you have so many documents and letters. Okay? The next thing, that's all Torah. Yeah?
Doesn't can also show though how far away, I mean, they're rebuilding the Second Temple, but how far away people had gotten from it. I mean, they seem...
Well, that's what Ezra, that was what we read about in Ezra. When Ezra comes to Jerusalem, this was in chapter 6. Chapter 6. Ezra comes, chapter 7. Right, Ezra comes, he realizes how far the Jewish people have fallen. Sorry, chapter 9. Right, he realizes how far the Jewish people have gone. He realizes the intermarriage. Yeah, that's why I said you really have to learn the book with a split screen. Screen number 1 is the excitement. Screen number 2 is the despair.
I mean, how is it that the Jewish people at this point earned or deserve to be building a town? It just sounds like they're so far fallen, like they just...
Yeah. You could ask that in many. You could ask why we deserve the exodus from Egypt. I mean, you know, we were in the 49th level of impurity. Why? You know, I'm not sure. But again, there was a prophecy, Haggai, Zechariah, but I don't know the reasons for why God decided to rebuild, but yeah.
You could ask the question a little differently. Here they are, busy doing something so holy, rebuilding the Second Temple, yet they're still intermarrying.
Right? You see that throughout Tanakh, though. And throughout Tanakh, you see, how was the temple destroyed? Right? They were doing these atrocious acts while the Beit HaMikdash was there.
But sometimes when you're used to, like, you can kind of take it for granted. It's here.
Right.
Here you're in the process of rebuilding it. There's a certain, usually, passion and excitement that comes with
in theory. As we'll get to, and this I'll come to it later on, not all the Jewish people were involved in the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. Right? Very few of them, actually, and that'll become important. Okay? Why so many lists? So lists, if you think about it, listing names. Right? So Josephus said, don't list the names. Just say a lot of people came back. The Navi is particular to literally list, I mean, pages of chapters and chapters of names. So one of the suggestions is that because post-prophecy, right, there's an emphasis on reminding us that the Jewish people can accomplish great things. Those individuals within a greater whole can accomplish great things if they just get on the bus, basically. Right? Lest you think that success is only determined by God telling the Jewish people, this is what you have to do. The laundry list of names in Sefer, Ezra, and Nehemiah are there to remind us that individuals can accomplish great things. That Am Yisrael, that the Jewish people, even without prophecy, can rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Even without prophecy, can rebuild Jerusalem. Even without prophecy, they can eradicate intermarriage from their midst. Okay? So again, you see the list is emphasizing the importance of the Jewish people, that even though they no longer have that direct conversation with God, there is still room for greatness. And the last point I want to make is that of leadership. I'm going to hand this out now. Start a little over here. Pass back and over. Okay. Okay. The styles of leadership. Okay. As I've alluded to, and I've tried to kind of foreshadow this along the way, is you see a dramatic difference between the leadership. I'll tell you where we're reading it. We're not reading yet. Okay. Even going?
Question.
Yeah.
So what conditions are different? If it's post-prophecy, what conditions for rebuilding are different now than then?
What conditions are different?
I mean, it was destroyed.
Well, they had always had a prophecy that the second Beit HaMikdash would be rebuilt. And those Haggai and Zechariah had already had, that's what we started off with. Right? They had had a prophecy that the Beit HaMikdash would be rebuilt. But that second Beit HaMikdash was the transition away from a state of prophecy. In other words, here it says, where was that? I'd referenced that at one point when they talk about the rebuilding, it says, in accordance with the prophecy of Haggai and Zechariah. But when they lived, they no longer lived with prophecy. Right? The same way when we learned, say, for Yirmiyahu. So their day-to-day activities, Yirmiyahu was coming along and saying, do this, don't do that. They no longer had that. So although the rebuilding may have been prophesized, their everyday life, their relationship with God, was no longer as a result of prophecy. That's a dramatic change of events. Okay? So that's more what I'm referring to. Okay. We talk about leadership. So I think I've already foreshadowed the difference between Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra, it was described as a sofer. He was the interpreter of the Torah. Okay? If you looked again in Sefer Ezra in chapter 7, which again, I've pointed a lot of this out already, but Ezra, chapter 7? Must have been chapter 9. Okay? That Ezra, he fasts, he chooses inspiration over forced when it comes to intermarriage. In other words, he doesn't beat the people down. He says, I'm going to model a religious approach to how to deal with a situation. That's his approach. Again, think post-prophecy. He no longer has God coming and saying, the Jewish people are doing something wrong, you have to do this. Ezra has to teach the people how to respond. What does he do? He sits there, he fasts, he tears his clothes, right? All of this is in response to intermarriage, response to the Jewish people sinning, but in a post-prophetic stage. And I'll even point out right now that tefillah is the next one, prayer. Right? Prayer makes appearances throughout the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Why is prayer so important? Because again, tefillah was the way that the Jewish people were going to interact with Hashem after prophecy ceased to exist. So if you look in chapter 9 in the book of Ezra, basically from verses 3 to 14, it's all about prayer, it's all about fasting, it's all about screaming out to God. Okay? He says specifically in verse 6, I said to God, my God, I am embarrassed and ashamed. In other words, Ezra's teaching the people how to relate to God when you no longer have prophecy. How are you going to do that? You're going to daven to Him. You're going to ask Him for forgiveness. You're going to ask Him for wisdom. That's all Ezra's approach. Nehemiah's approach is dramatically different. Okay? You don't see Nehemiah playing the role of the scribe. You don't see Nehemiah playing the role of spiritual advisor. What is Nehemiah always doing? He's the doer. Okay? We're introduced to Nehemiah. Where is he? He's in the king's palace. He's achieved a great level of stature. Okay? When he comes, what do we see Nehemiah doing? So he's a little bit manipulative. He's creative, right? He's not telling anyone why he's there. He's kind of scouting out the scene, right? He's much more of a military mindset, so to speak, okay? When he's faced with the needy, right, when I the socioeconomic challenges, how does he respond, right? He basically threatens these landlords. He says, you better give back that land because we've already lost enough Jewish people. I don't want to lose more toward you guys. Right, he takes a very forceful stance. And lastly, when it came to intermarriage, as we saw, he literally beats the people down. Nehemiah has his little army, and he's walking around town like thugs. And if he literally, this is not me. Turn to page chapter 13. Right? That's what he's doing. He's walking around and he's scaring people into undoing their intermarriage. I'm not making up these words. We read them earlier. Right? I cursed them. I beat some of them. I tore their hair out. I made them swear by God that you will give your daughters over. Right? Again, he literally beating them in the streets. Okay? So he was a thug. He wasn't a thug, but he was somewhat of a thug. Okay? If you look here, I gave out a sheet. Adin Steinzel has a brilliant sefer. I recommend anyone who has not yet read it to read it. Because what he does is he goes personality by personality and tries to capture what makes that personality unique. After learning a lot of Tanakh, as you guys have done, from 30,000 feet, his book will be fascinating. Because what he'll do is he'll take a lot of the characters that you've learned about and create basically a personality profile to them, which I find interesting. It's called Biblical Images. Okay? If you look on page 180, So it's the page. It's the side that has words on both sides of the page. Page 180. And it's exactly midway through the page where it says one of the situations recounted. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's the second full paragraph. Okay? You got it? One of the situations recounted in the Bible, which rather neatly delineates this contrast between the two leaders, is their reaction to intermarriage. With, in the participation in the abominable practices, the Canaanim, Chittim, etc. When Ezra learned of the offense of these exiles, he said, I rent my garments and my mantle and plucked off my hair of my head and my beard and sat down appalled. Nehemiah learned of it in another context and noted, I contended with them, cursed them, smote certain of them and plucked off my hair. In other words, Ezra was appalled and plucked out his own hair, while Nehemiah was angry and tore out the hair of the offenders. At least in immediate terms, Nehemiah's tactics appear to be much more effective. He succeeded in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and in putting the community on a sound social and economic footing. In any case, he helped to make it possible for the new Jewish state to withstand the pressures of its enemies and to grow into significant spiritual and political entity. Right? He says that Nehemiah was incredibly effective. He rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash, the walls, in 52 days. Think about that. 52 days. You don't get to that by being an ineffective political leader. Okay? So he says, whereas Nehemiah, was much more of that brute force, he says Ezra is different. If you look at the other side of the page, all the way at the bottom, I have a little bracket there. Last paragraph on 181. It may therefore be inferred that Ezra endeavored to accomplish something unprecedented. He and his companions strove for something that went beyond the physical restitution of the state. Right, Nehemiah was in charge of the physical. He built the walls. Okay, he was the builder. He made sure that it was on sound political and economic footing. Coming as Ezra, the priest and the scribe, charged with the task of reinstituting the law of the Torah of the land, he saw himself as a teacher and a guide, an ideological leader. This ideological factor, 182 at the top now, this ideological factor was indeed paramount in all his actions and complemented his singular personality. When the king offered to provide him with a private guard, he refused, on the ground that as a person who claimed to receive divine help, he felt it would be ridiculous to rely on a body of soldiers for protection. And this, in spite of the fact that he was not a little frightened. Right, what did Nehemiah do? The exact opposite. Right, as we learned that when the Nunnikim were protesting against Nehemiah, he established guards. Remember, that's what we learned, that they had one hand on the sword and one hand on the brick and mortar. Okay? Ezra was quite aware of the need for other methods besides the ideologically inspired one. He knew he could not force a value system upon the unwilling. Consequently, he tried to bring the people to the desired point of acceptance of their own free will. This inevitably led to the difficulties and opposition from all directions, and at least at the first stage, much of what attempted to be shown, few results, if any. Okay? So again, whereas Nehemiah was results-oriented, Nehemiah was pushing his will on other people, whether it was with intermarriage, whether it was about the socioeconomic challenges, Ezra was much more, I'm going to model and hope that people follow suit. Okay? And we saw that they were both somewhat effective. In other words, there was a place in both of them, for both of them. Just one more paragraph down, where it starts Ezra. Ezra therefore called for fasts and for public demonstrations of solidarity and penitence. He felt that the coercive powers vested in him by virtue of his royal powers were not suited to his aim. Okay, so again, a very different, and you can read the rest on your own, right? Very different styles of leadership. Okay. That is in terms of the major themes.
Rabbi?
Yes?
How does Nehemiah get so involved in the religious aspect of it? How does he manage to take up the mantle of Ezra with respect to the intermarriages? He's there to reconstruct, and suddenly he becomes involved in the spiritual activities of the...
Well, who said he was there to reconstruct?
He was sent there by the... He tells the king... I'm coming there, I have to rebuild it, it's in bad shape. There's no
way. No, that was Nehemiah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so why does Nehemiah get involved in intermarriage?
Why is Nehemiah?
Right. Nehemiah is still a spiritual, he's still a religious personality. Just when we're profiling the people, Nehemiah is clearly depicted one way, and Ezra is clearly depicted another way. That doesn't mean that Nehemiah as a leader isn't also concerned about the spiritual state of the Jewish people. What I'm pointing at is how they approach it differently. Okay? Ezra approaches it in a more of a passive role modeling way, whereas Nehemiah approaches it in much more of a heavy-handed kind of way. And as I showed, that's Nehemiah's approach to everything. The same way he approaches the spiritual element with a heavy hand, so too he approaches the physical, the physical building, with a heavy hand. That was his approach. That's who he was. That's how he approached the building of the walls. That's why he was able to do it in 52 days. And that's how he approached the problem of intermarriage. So just because he was we think of him as more of a politically minded person, he was still in charge of the religious components as well.
Is there any indication that he was?
Yeah, he gets involved in Shabbos desecration. He gets involved in intermarriage. That could be why chapters 8 and 9 of Nehemiah deal with Ezra as well. In other words, it happens on his watch that they're taking out the Torahs, that they're reading, that they're teaching people about Torah. One doesn't have to be exclusive of the other.
If I were Ezra, I might be a little bit put out by the methods that is being used to force the Israelites to
come. Right. So we don't see how Ezra and Nehemiah interact. Right? We don't see if one approved of the other's methods or not. I assume, as an observer learning this, that the Navi is purposefully contrasting the two of them to show us that you need both. Right? And this is not new. You'll have a Kohen Gadol, and you'll have a Nasi. Right? One being more of a political entity, and one being more of a religious entity. Right? We've Moshe and Aaron. Okay. Aaron was more of the loving, caring. Aaron was a Kohen, the educator. Moshe was you have contrasting forms of leadership playing itself out. So I assume that they're contrasting Ezra and Nehemiah purposefully, saying that there are times when more of an Ezra model is needed, and there are times when a Nehemiah model is needed, or within one person, you need both sometimes. But one without the other might not necessarily always be effective. I think the Navi purposefully contrasts the two of those. And I think that's why we read Ezra and Nehemiah together, to show us that both were needed to guide the Jewish people through this transition.
I always thought that Ezra was there for the spiritual part, and the other one was there for the reconstruction.
Well, that's how we think of them. But again, it might not necessarily be as clear cut as we just saw. Any other questions? And I just want to, we're running short on time. Okay, so again, we have prayer, we have leadership, we have lists, we have Torah, all guiding us in that transition from prophecy to a post-prophetic world. Okay, it's very clear right now that we're not going to be able to go very in-depth in the chapters, but I want to point out a couple things. Number one is the story of Purim. Okay, this is somewhat tangential and somewhat not tangential at all. Okay, if you look... Sorry, I'm just trying to condense things quickly to make sure I get to my major points. Okay. If you look in, let me just find it quickly. Okay. If you give me a second, sorry. Actually, I have a number written down. I'm trying to find where I wrote down the specific number. Yeah, here we go. If you look, the amount of people that are listed that came back in the book of Ezra, you come out to the number 42,000. Okay? So when we talk about the Aliyah of Ezra, we're talking about 42,000 Jews. Is that a lot or a little?
It's a lot in those days.
You think it's a lot? It's generally considered a little. It's not a lot of people. Right? The Jewish people were much more than 42,000. What?
Eligible.
So we're assuming that so the Navi says it's 42,000. I'm going to assume that that's not a lot of people. When you think about how many were sent into exile, I think it's not a lot of people. I think there were a lot more people that stayed in the exile than came back. And I think I'm going to make that point in just a second. Okay? When we talk about the story of Purim, so you'll see why I'm talking about Purim. Okay? So we don't know why the Jewish people sinned. Okay? The Megillah never really tells us. We just see them feasting at a meal of Achashverosh. Okay? At the beginning of the book of... Who taught Esther here?
Rabbi Levine.
So I hope he pointed this out. But at the beginning of Esther, you see a tremendous amount of description of Persian culture. Okay? Which you don't find in many other books. Okay? What's also bizarre is that there's no mention of the fact that the Beit HaMikdash is being rebuilt as the story of Esther's taking place. Which is also bizarre. You would think that there would be some linkage between the two stories. What I want to suggest is that much of the book of Esther is a shtuch, is some form of a patch to the Jewish people. Okay? Why? Because they had the opportunity to return and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and only 40,000 did. Okay? The rest chose to remain in Persia as opposed to going back and rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? Now, if that's the case, and this is not my thesis, this is Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, has a beautiful article on Torah.org about it. Strongly recommend everyone reading it. Okay? If that's the case, then that becomes the sin. Right? What was the sin of the Jewish people in the time of Mordechai and Esther? It was that they chose to stay in the diaspora as opposed to using the opportunity to go back to the land of Israel. Okay? That's why you have so much description in the first two chapters of Esther of Beit HaMikdash imagery. Right? Afterwards, go back, look back at the first two chapters of Esther. Tchelet, Chur, all of the descriptions are vikelim, right? The vessels. Chazal tells those are the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. That Achashverosh is sitting there partying with the vessel, with the vestments of the Kohen Gadol. He's sitting there partying with the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. He's sitting there partying with the Tchelet and the Chur, all of these descriptions that we saw over the last few weeks in describing the Mishkan, right? That the Jewish... Why? Because that was the hidden imagery of the Beit HaMikdash. But again, as Achashverosh is parting with it, you could be in the land of Israel. And I also believe that that's why there's no mention of Yerushalayim in the book of Mordechai and Esther, in the book of Esther. Why? Because these were the Jews who decided not to go. History was unfolding in Yerushalayim at that time, and only 40,000 chose to come back. Okay? And I think parenthetically, right, when we talk about the relevance of Tanakh, that makes Tanakh very relevant. Because you now see tremendous parallels between the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and what I'll call modern day Israel. Right? You have foreign powers granting the Jewish people the rights to go back to our homeland. You had Cyrus in the beginning of Esther, and obviously contemporary modern day Israel, you had the United Nations who granted us the ability to go back. Okay? You have people who had been living there for a long time who are not happy about the newcomers. Right? I don't need to detail that to you in modern day Israel, but certainly throughout the book of Ezra, that's why I think such an emphasis is placed on Sanballat and on Tovia and on the Nudniks throughout the story. They don't want us there. We're treading on their territory. Okay? You have a tremendous amount of conflict over that. You have discussions with the outside powers, right? Do you know what the Jewish people are really doing there? You may have given them permission to return, but now that they're there, what are their motives? Are they trying to encroach on our territory? Are they trying to rebel? Really questioning their right to be there. Okay? And lastly, not everyone wanted to return. And that was perhaps part of the meta-narrative throughout the story of Esther, throughout the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. So again, the reason why I highlight that is to show that the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah, and this is why I said in a certain respect, the story of Ezra and Nehemiah is the most relevant to us nowadays. Because it's the story of a people returning to Yerushalayim, returning to rebuild the temple, and the challenges that that might face with itself. We have a few more minutes, so let's just look at a few psukim inside. A lot of this I covered when I went through it at the beginning, but just a few major points. I actually covered a lot of this. I went out of order of my notes, but I covered a lot of this. Let's do a little bit in Nehemiah, because we didn't do as much of that. Okay, if you look in Nehemiah, let's read one more part of Nehemiah, just to give you another sense of their leadership styles. Okay, we glanced over this, but if you look in chapter 5 of Nehemiah, and I show this again to highlight Nehemiah's personality. We discussed intermarriage. I glanced over the socioeconomic parts, but let's read that inside. Okay, Nehemiah writes, "Now the outcry of the people and their wives concerning their Jewish brethren was great. There were those who said, 'With our sons and with our daughters we are numerous, and we must buy grain that we will eat and remain alive.'" In other words, they were starving. "And there were those who said, 'We are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our homes to buy grain during the famine,'" and etc. In other words, people didn't have enough money. Okay, so what happens? Verse 6, chapter 5, verse 6. "I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these matters. Then my heart moved me, and I confronted the aristocrats and the nobles and said to them, 'Are you creditors of loans against your brothers?' And I gathered a large crowd around them. I said to them, 'We have ransomed our brother, Jews, who were sold to Gentiles for as much as we could afford. Now will you sell your brothers again only to be resold to us?' They were silent. They could not find a response." So he basically calls that the Jews were oppressing the Jews. And he says to them, "What are you trying to do? We've lost so many. You're going to oppress us even further." And they had no response. "Then I said, 'The thing you are doing is not good. Surely you will walk with the fear of God because of the scorn of the nations and our enemies. I and my brethren and my servants as well have lent them money and grain. Let us all now relinquish this debt. Return to them now this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their homes, as well as hundreds in money and the grains and the vines and the oil sent them, etc. They replied, 'We shall return it all. We will make no demands of them. We shall do as you say.'" So again, when you talk about the effectiveness of Ezra versus Nehemiah, Nehemiah was effective. His heavy-handed approach was effective. It was effective here. It was affected by their intermarriage. I think part of, again, just to go back to that notion, part of the reason why you have both Ezra and Nehemiah is because you have to question how effective Nehemiah's approach would have been in the long term. Right? How effective a heavy-handed approach is in the long run. And I think that's why the Navi specifically contrasts the personalities of Ezra and Nehemiah to show that you need the loving, caring personality, the personality who's going to lead by example, and the more heavy-handed personality as well. Those are the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Next week, Divrei HaYamim is going to tie everything together, and you will finish the course.